Right now, wind north at 12, 40 degrees Kenosha, 38 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am excited that we can start this week with a newcomer to the Morning Show, paying what I assume is going to be just the first of a number of appearances on the Morning Show, State Assembly Majority Leader Tyler August, who is the state representative for the 31st Assembly District in Walworth County. And as I said, also serving currently as Assembly Majority Leader. And we're going to be getting a little background information from him since this is his first time on the Morning Show. And then we'll dig into a few details, primarily his party's response to the proposed state budget of Governor Evers. And we'll touch on a couple of other matters as well. Tyler August, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad we can have this conversation. And as I said, since this is your first visit to the Morning Show, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about you in terms of where you are from originally and so on, and maybe at least a summary of your sort of life's path that ultimately has taken you to the state legislature.
Yeah, sure. So born and raised in Walworth, as you mentioned, in Walworth County. And that's currently where I reside now. Born and raised there, went to Bigfoot High School, attended UW-Eau Claire and UW-Madison, and during my time in college, I got an internship in the state capitol working for State Senator Neil Kedzie, so I did that while I was in school, and upon graduation, got a job answering the phones for who turned out to be my predecessor, Representative Tom Lothian. And worked for him for 6 years, and he decided to retire from the legislature at the young age of 80. And when he retired, when he told me he was going to retire and not seek re-election, he suggested, it being where I lived in my hometown district, that it might be something I should take a look at running for. So I did that, took a look at it, talked to community members and family, and decided to run. I won a six-way primary in 2010 to become the Republican nominee, and then went on to, of course, win the general election in a safe Republican seat, and have been had the honor and privilege of serving my friends and neighbors in the state legislature ever since.
I think some people who run for public office, especially for something like a position in the state legislature, state assembly or Senate, perhaps imagine it to be one thing and it turns out to be another. I am guessing that because of your years working for people who were living this life, that probably not too much of this has been a surprise in terms of what it is like to actually be a state representative versus working for one.
Sure. I mean, I would say that when I was first running, I of course leaned on my experience, and that's what I talked to folks about, that I could hit the ground running right out of the gate and didn't have to figure out where the bathrooms were or anything like that, that I could actually get right to work. But I will say that once you're sworn in and you raise your right hand and take that oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin and the United States, you can it feels different than you think it would. It's an awesome responsibility, and you really do feel the weight of it once it's your name on the door of the office versus serving the district in a different way by being a staffer. So it's while some of it was not a surprise, certainly because I had the experience in the Capitol prior to running. I was a little surprised, I think, at the weight of the responsibility and how you really feel that once you know that you're there to represent the 60,000 individuals that live within the district with you.
Hmm. We're speaking with Assembly Majority Leader Tyler August. Could you just say a quick word about that particular responsibility and to what extent that has had some surprises in terms of what that entails and what that has meant for you and, for one thing, your workload?
Yeah, sure. So being the majority leader I've been the majority leader for a little over 2 years now. It's about 2.5 years, which I was the speaker pro tem for almost 10 years before that, which is kind of the procedural chief, the person in the chair when we're in session, the kind of the parliamentarian role, which I certainly enjoyed that role. But after 10 years of doing it, our majority leader decided not to seek re-election. Jim Steinecke and members of the caucus came to me and encouraged me to run to be the majority leader, given my experience as part of the leadership team. And so it was a smooth transition, but it certainly is a different role. When I was the speaker pro tem, it was kind of my job to protect the minority from the majority, even though I was a member of the majority. I always would say that the majority gets their way, the minority gets their say. And that was an important role that I took very seriously. And I think if you asked Democrats that served with me in the legislature at the time, I would hope that they would say that that they appreciated the way that I would make sure that the majority didn't just run roughshod over them, and that they were able to participate in the debate, whether they were supporting or not supporting the issue in front of us. And now, as the majority leader, it's really my job to work with all of my 53 colleagues on the Republican side more closely to get their initiatives passed, to present ideas to the entire caucus that I believe need to be moved forward, and just work with everybody on a daily basis to make sure that the needs of their districts are being met, while at the same time, and most importantly, making sure that the needs of my own district are being met, because ultimately, I always say that I have 60,000 bosses back home, but I have 53 bosses in the Capitol, but the 60,000 come before the 53.
Hmm. Let's talk about your party's response to the proposed state budget of Governor Evers, and I think it's fair to say that there is a fair amount in his budget proposal with which you are unhappy and taking serious issue. What would you say is essentially at the top in terms of most pressing concerns, and what do you and your party plan to do about that?
Sure. So I would say one of the biggest concerns in the governor's budget is, and he didn't talk about this in his budget address when he delivered his budget to us a little over a month ago, I think, here, there's a couple $1 billion in tax increases in his budget to fund a lot of the new government programs that he's proposing. It's unfortunate because the governor has been around a while, and he knows that our caucus is just not going to raise taxes, especially in these times of inflationary periods and the cost of living going up and people having fewer dollars, the same dollars going not as far. We're just not going to be in the business of raising taxes on the hardworking people of Wisconsin. And so when he builds his budget around tax increases, it's virtually impossible for us to take his document seriously, because it's built really kind of on a house of cards and shell games of moving money around that we're just not going to do. And so, unfortunately, like we've had to do every time he's proposed a budget, we are going to kind of throw his budget out, and we are going to start from scratch, as we've done, and build a product that that prioritizes what Wisconsinites care about, but also keeps things within their ability to pay for it. Because ultimately, it's the taxpayers' money. It's not my money. It's not the governor's money. It's the taxpayers' money, and we need to make sure that we're making decisions that reflect their priorities. And unfortunately, his document just doesn't do that.
You not only take issue with what you're describing as tax increases that are part of the governor's budget, but actually want to see tax relief, and actually quite significant tax relief for Wisconsin citizens. Explain kind of the dimensions of the tax relief that that you envision for Wisconsin, and how exactly that has been crafted.
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of folks have heard about there being a $4 billion surplus, which is true, but we only have that surplus because of the tax cuts that the governor has vetoed over the last several years. Our caucus priority is to return that surplus to the taxpayers. We believe that when there is a surplus, that means it doesn't mean that government hasn't spent enough. It means that we've collected too much tax revenue, and that should be refunded back to the taxpayers. So I'm of the position that all tax cuts are good. I like some more than others, but anytime we can reduce the tax burden on people in Wisconsin, I think it's important to do so. So our caucus has prioritized things like we would like to eliminate the tax on retirement income for our middle class seniors who have worked all their lives and are now on a fixed income due to their retirement. We think that that would be a huge win for our retirees and also for Wisconsin workers as they plan for their retirement. And there's also discussions about just lowering the middle class income taxes across the board to try and put some more dollars in the pockets of everyday hardworking Wisconsinites that just need a little extra help in these times of things costing more. So again, all tax cuts are good, but those are a couple that I think our caucus is rallying behind, and we hope that the governor will meet us in the middle and finally sign some of these tax cuts for the people who need them.
There isn't time available to us today to talk about too much in the way of specifics, but if you don't mind, I'd like to zero in specifically on two facets of education. One of them is that there have been a flurry of referendums all across the state involving public schools. And in fact, in WGTD's listening area this past Tuesday, there were 10 school referendums. And so clearly something is going on in our public schools in terms of budgetary pressure, and from certain sectors, at least, there have been calls for kind of the formula by which state aid to public schools is maybe reexamined. Do you see any merit in that, and or any possibility of that happening in the near future? I mean, otherwise, what can be done to help ensure that public schools can continue to do what they need to do?
Sure. So the first part of it, I'll take the referendum piece first. I have long been a supporter of the referendum process in Wisconsin. I believe that the state puts reasonable revenue limits on both local governments and schools, because back in the 90s, it would have been the school districts didn't have any limits, and many of them were just taxing people out of their homes. I mean, they were just raising the property tax exponentially, and people just couldn't afford to pay it. And so people who were around long before me made the wise decision to put revenue caps on school districts, and we've allowed those to increase over time. But I also think that the voters have the ultimate responsibility for deciding if they want to pay more in their property taxes to fund their school district or not. And so I think it adds a major incentive for school districts to sell themselves to their community, to show that they can provide a high-quality product and educate children at a high level. And when they do that, communities generally approve referendums to allow their own taxes, to raise taxes on themselves because they believe in their school district. So that process, I believe, has been functional. People talk about the number of referendums, and it's true there have been a lot, but it's also true that a lot of a major majority of referendums do end up passing because local voters decide that their community school is worth investing in, and they do that with their tax dollars. The second part, the school revenue funding formula is somewhat broken, and it has been for a long time, and I've worked to try and make some changes to it over the years. Hopefully, as the majority leader now, it'll be a little easier. The formula is extremely complicated. There's only a handful of people in the state that actually fully understand it. But it's largely based on equalized value, on the value of the property within a school district. And the higher the value of the property, the lower the state aid becomes. And so when people call me and say, hey, Tyler, you need to put that $4 billion surplus into schools, the problem is if we put it just into the school funding formula as it is, most of it will get chewed up by larger municipalities like Milwaukee, which just passed a $250 million referendum about a year ago to continue their operations. And Milwaukee and Madison and Beloit and other large metropolitan areas end up sucking up most of that money, and our smaller rural schools, because of the way the formula is written, get far less. And so I have not been a huge proponent of just pushing a bunch of money into the funding formula for those reasons, but I am a proponent of making some changes to that formula so it can be more equitably distributed around the state. The issue with that is anytime you do that, there are school districts that will view themselves as winners and others that will view themselves as losers. And so putting together 50 votes to make a significant change to the funding formula and also making a change that can get signed by the governor is the challenging part of trying to tweak that formula at all.
Right. If we could touch briefly on the university system, I've spoken to one of your Republican colleagues who is also a graduate of the UW system, and by several different measures, the state's support of the UW system lags behind many other states in the country. I mean, by at least some measures, rank in the low 40s in terms of level of support to the university system. Do you see any path forward to that changing, or do you feel like the state's support of the UW system is, generally speaking, about where it needs to be or where it has to be?
Sure. So it's a complicated question that the answer could be yes and no. Part of the issue is the university system. You don't have to, you don't have to go look too far to find stories about how they are wasting money on DEI programs and all this other kind of liberal indoctrination type programs instead of focusing on educating students and preparing them for their next chapter in life. So I think before our caucus is going to be willing to put any kind of significant investment into the UW system, they really need to get their act together and prove to the taxpayers that the investment is worth it. And I think that at least when I'm in my district, I don't hear a huge clamoring from my constituents telling me that we need to increase funding for the university system. Usually when the university system comes up in conversations with constituents, they're complaining about one of two things, either some sort of, crazy idea that the university is pushing in their classrooms, or more commonly, their senior in high school with a solid GPA and a solid class ranking and a solid ACT or SAT score is waitlisted and doesn't get into a University of Wisconsin program. And I think that the universities need to do a better job of realizing that they are heavily subsidized by Wisconsin taxpayers, and so Wisconsin students should be in the driver's seat and have the first opportunity to attend those campuses versus out-of-state or out-of-country students.
Right. Last quick question. The most recent election was a little bit better for the Democrats than for the Republicans. My question to you is, what do you take away from Tuesday's election and in terms of going forward? And does it in any way shift or kind of reshape your thinking on anything that we have touched on today?
No, not really. I think my biggest takeaway is that this election is boiled down to way more Democrats showed up to vote than Republicans. And it really does boil down to just that. But when you look across the state at where the Democrats showed up, it's in those urban areas, Milwaukee, Madison, Dane County. And that's where they really, their turnout, you have to give your hats off to the Democrats' turnout machine, because they turned their people out, and Republicans did not do as good of a job. So that's how the election unfolded. But I do think that it's still important to note that while things didn't go the way that I would have wanted them to, either in the Supreme Court or the DPI race, the voters did approve the constitutional amendment to require a photo ID to vote in the state of Wisconsin. And so now the rogue Supreme Court that has really kind of turned into a kangaroo court, or something more accurately described as what a court you would see in a banana republic, which is now our Supreme Court, and the way that they legislate from the bench and break rules and not really care about the separation of powers. So while that's all true, we do now have the protection that they will not be able to undo voter ID, because the voters have spoken and have enshrined it in the Constitution. And so that's the biggest win from an election standpoint from Tuesday, is that we have that protection in place now.
Tyler August is the representative for the 31st Assembly District and the majority leader in the Wisconsin Assembly. Tyler August, I'm glad we had this conversation. I look forward to further conversations on the morning show. Thank you so much.
Yep, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to the Morning Show archives to play an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2017. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I am exceptionally excited to be speaking with highly acclaimed novelist Don Winslow. He has 19 novels to his credit, including the number one international bestseller, The Cartel. He brings to the task of writing novels an exceptionally varied personal resume of life experience, including work as a former investigator, anti-terrorist trainer, and trial consultant. For his latest novel called The Force, Don Winslow engaged in quite meticulous and thorough research on what it is like to be a policeman in a city like New York City. Mr. Winslow spoke with all kinds of police officers, young and old alike, and then drew upon that rich experience to write his novel called The Force, which is published by William Morrow. You're quoted as saying, "This is the book I've wanted to write my whole life." Explain what's behind those words.
You know, I was born on Staten Island in New York. This is a New York book. I've lived in and worked in New York on and off my whole life. And as a kid, I was tremendously influenced and excited by films like and books like The French Connection, Serpico, Prince of the City. And I'd always hoped that maybe someday I could write a book in that vein, in that genre. I think that this was the right time of my career to write it. I think that I finally had the sort of skills and the chops, if you will, to do it. And also I wanted to do, you know, something in that vein that was contemporary, that spoke about things that are happening today, and this just seemed like a rich time to do it.
If I remember correctly, somewhere in your biography, you spent some time working as a private investigator. I'm curious, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's part of your resume. I wonder how long ago was that? How long did you do that? And to what extent is that a significant contributor to the way you're able to write a book like this so richly and authentically?
No, you've got that right. I did that on and off for probably close to 20 years. I started it here on a very kind of low-level kind of street guy here in New York, in Times Square, in fact, before Mickey Mouse arrived and cleaned it up. It certainly contributed because, you know, I had a sense of the streets, but more importantly, I worked with cops, I got to know cops, and that really helped inform this book.
One of the things that I'm really impressed with is that your book is full of characters, including your main character, this Denny Malone, a veteran of the NYPD as a detective sergeant. In some ways, he and a lot of the characters in your book feel like people we've met, people we've known. I would hesitate to call them stereotypes because they feel so much more real, so much more authentic than that. And yet, somehow there is a sense of the familiar, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. But the reason I bring it up is because I suspect as the author, you are walking kind of a fine line here in terms of creating characters that are very real and unique and yet not falling into very predictable sorts of patterns. Can you talk about that challenge?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. You know, and it is a challenge because there are certain standards. There are certain, you know, things that you kind of expect from a cop book. And in a way, that's almost unavoidable because, of course, cops do certain things, you know, and don't do others. And they have certain personalities. That's what makes them cops. But for me, character is everything in a book. I don't start writing a book until I know the character, the main characters, really well. Until they're, I'll pick up on your word, familiar to me. And I feel comfortable with them, and I feel that I know what they're going to do and what they're going to say. And then I try to share that with the reader, you know, so that we step into these characters' lives, and we do feel familiar with them. You know, I like to have a character get up and have a cup of coffee and then go walk the neighborhood, and the reader takes that walk with the character so that we do get to feel familiar and close with that guy.
You did a lot of research with this book. That is, you got to know all kinds of cops in New York City. Just say a quick word about how you did that and how you managed to make those interactions with them real. So they were, in a sense, showing you their real selves and not, you know, putting up a careful, tidy front.
Sure. You know, look, I mean, I think that you used the correct word. To make the relationship real, you have real relationships. And I was very upfront about what I was doing. And what I really said to them was, look, I'm not so interested in what you do. I'm interested in how you feel about it. I'm interested in what you think about it. I'm interested in your work, but I'm more interested in your life. And it was a matter of spending time. It was a matter of having conversations. Now, I've known cops my whole adult life. And so some of these conversations were interviews like you and I are having, but most of them were longer conversations, some that went on for days and weeks, and others that have been going on for decades.
Mm. We're speaking with Don Winslow about his latest novel, which is called The Force. This is his 20th novel, and it's absolutely marvelous. One of the choices you make in your book is to, in a sense, begin towards the very end of the story of Denny Malone.
Yes.
And so we know from the moment we open the book up that things are going to turn out pretty badly for him, and then you rewind. And it's a device that we see from time to time, but I should think it's a risk to in a sense give away a large portion of the end of the story. Was there any particular reason why you chose to frame the book in this way?
Yeah, sure. And I thought it was a risk also, by the way. I kept going back and forth on whether I wanted to do that or not. At the end of the day, though, I decided I wanted to write not a book that asked what, but a book that asked why. And so I wanted to put the reader in this trap, in this really terrible situation with Denny from the get-go. So you had that sort of intensity and you had that kind of desperation. And it's the only book I've ever written, by the way, in which it's seen through one character's point of view the whole way. So I wanted to start in that intense situation, not let Denny or the reader out of it until the end of the book, and then explain the whys and the hows of how we got there.
You described Denny Malone as someone who has felt the gravity of 18 years on the job, and yet it's a job that he thinks is the best job in the world. And I'm so intrigued by that, in a sense, mixed message. and I guess what we're talking about are the mixed feelings of Denny Malone, who finds this work to be, in many ways, a terrible burden, and yet it's a job he absolutely loves. Is that something you heard from a lot of New York cops you got to know?
Absolutely, and not only New York cops. You know, I interviewed a lot of cops from all over the country, by the way. But there is a love-hate relationship with the job, no question. In the one sense, they feel very privileged and lucky, and they love what they do. And one thing, you know, I really learned in this research is how much cops care about the job they do, how much they care about the victims, how much they care about the victims' families, how badly they do really want to keep people safe. And that's a really sincere desire, despite some of the kind of tough and sometimes cynical front that they put up. You know, it's no fun writing simplistic characters. You know, I like to write characters that are conflicted, that do have nuanced points of view about their lives and what they do. But I think that one's an absolutely realistic one.
And I really appreciated the fact that you pointed out that police officers, we always tend to think of them as interacting with the perpetrators of crime, with criminals. But you point out quite rightly that, well, your words are, people forget that the cops see first the victims and then the perpetrators.
Right.
They see victims upon victims upon victims. And you also say that in some crazy way, at some point, they really have to be careful not to feel too much for the victims, and that at some points it actually becomes tempting to hate the victim too. Say a word about that strange reality.
It's a psychological defense mechanism. You know, these men and women go out on all levels of this job, you know, depending on where they're assigned. But if you're in one of these units, a homicide unit, a drug unit, other kinds of, you know, units that hit violent crimes, they see suffering. They see pain. And it's up front and in their faces all the time. You know, you and I might see it for a few minutes on the evening news or in our newspaper. The cops are the ones who go to the scene, see it, smell it. They go to the emergency rooms. They go to the morgues. They go, and they're the ones that go to the victims' families to say, your son, your brother, your daughter's not coming home ever. So they feel tremendous empathy. But they do have to be careful that sometimes that empathy doesn't get in the way of being clear-headed and a little cold-blooded about trying to solve the crime. And then there is this psychological defense mechanism, because they start feeling so much empathy for the victims that they do start resenting them in a little bit of a way. Do you know what I mean? Because it's just so much pain in their lives day after day after day.
This is one of my favorite passages in the book, is where you have Malone thinking this to himself. The real problem, Malone thinks, is when you start hating the victim too, and you do, it just wears you down. Their pain becomes yours. The responsibility for their suffering weighs on your shoulders. You didn't do enough to protect them. You were in the wrong place. You didn't catch the perp earlier. You start blaming yourself and or you start blaming the victim. Why are they so vulnerable? Why so weak? Why do they live in those conditions? Why do they join gangs, sling drugs? Why do they have to shoot each other over nothing? Why are they such blankety-blank animals? I mean, you're really putting us in the shoes of police officers and what they deal with on an emotional level. I also appreciated the fact that you really help us understand the way in which police officers can find themselves tempted to cross a line, particularly if they see themselves, as Denny Malone does, as a landscaper. Explain how a cop might see their role in a community as a landscaper. It's a fascinating concept.
Because they're trying to shape the territory. You know, in precincts, of course, have geographical territories, and within those precincts there are districts. There's all kinds of language for this, depending on where you are. What a cop's job too often is to contain crime as opposed to solve it. You know, they're trying to control it. So they are trying to keep it within certain boundaries. So they're trying to create certain safe zones, and they sometimes do that by driving crime into narrower areas and literally shaping the landscape of crime in their precinct.
In his words, our job is to keep the jungle from growing back.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thought. Quickly, say a word about sort of the core of the story that gets Denny Malone into such trouble.
Yeah, you know, let's be just very blunt about it. You know, this is an 18-year veteran of the force who makes the biggest heroin bust in the city's history, and he and his partners steal half the drugs and half the money and keep them. And he gets caught.
And he navigates a really tough road from that point on, and we really feel for him to a surprising extent. Even if we hate what he did, we understand why he did it, and that makes it an especially rich situation dramatically. I want you to say a word about the 2.5 pages that are at the very front of your novel. It is a dedication, and to tell our listeners about the 178 names that they will see there.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. The 178 names are law enforcement officers across the country who were killed just during the time I was typing this book. You know, from the time I sat down to actually write it to the time I wrote the end, 178 men and women were murdered for being police officers while on duty. And I felt that I should name them, and we should read those names.
The novel is The Force. It's published by William Morrow and the author Don Winslow. Don Winslow, congratulations on a superb book. I really, really loved it, found it powerful and haunting, and I'm really grateful for this opportunity to speak with you about it. Best wishes.
Well, thank you, Greg. I appreciate it. Thanks for the great interview.
You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and to finish out today's program, a memorable conversation from back in 2015 with environmental activist and paralegal Aaron Brockovich. We all know the name Aaron Brockovich and the tireless work which first put her on the map, trying to make the world a little bit safer, especially for ordinary people who, for no fault of their own, find themselves living in the wake of environmental damage. And now, in addition to that work which she has continued to do, Aaron Brockovich is a very fine writer, and she has co-written a couple of well-received novels, the most recent of which is called Hot Water. And we're going to talk with her for the next few minutes about this next step in her journey. Aaron Brockovich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. I look forward to talking to you very much. You and C.J. Lyons have co-written a couple of novels, Rock Bottom and now Hot Water, which obviously spring out of this real-life crusade of yours to make the world a bit safer for ordinary families. Could you tell us how this started? Was this something that somebody suggested to you, or on your own did you realize that this might be a fun and fruitful undertaking for you?
Well, you know, I've been 21 years, gosh, I hate to date myself, that I've actually been working with communities on environmental issues. And, you know, it's been over the past few years, I see, I'd say despair in communities. And it's just such an overwhelming concept to hear or face that through groundwater contamination or air pollution or soil vapor plumes underneath people's homes, that they have environmental problems, and sometimes it gets so overwhelming we just tune out. We turn on that deaf ear. And the idea of the novels, and we call them a cause novel, is to have a character in there that many people would relate to, that they could just have some escapism, if you will, and read something, but close the book and go, wait a minute, that is a real cause. It could be happening in this country. It could be, frankly, happening in my own backyard, and I want to get involved. So that was the idea, just seeing communities oftentimes thinking, oh, I just can't deal with this, or I don't want to deal with this. And so AJ is a fun character, and it's a series based on things that might really be happening and a way to get people to want to become involved.
We're talking about an environmental activist named Angela Joy Palladino, and obviously she is a very powerful echo of you and some of the work that you've done. How would you characterize her in terms of being similar to you versus being distinct from you? I mean, have you and co-author C.J. Lyons gone out of your way to make her a lot like you or different from you? How have you handled that?
Well, certainly somewhat like me, but possibly, you know, I guess like a whole lot of people might be. And so it's a little bit of me in there, but AJ kind of has a... She's maybe a little more jaded in some regards, but that's what I love about her. She's rolling her eyes a lot of times, and sometimes things pop out of her mouth that's something that every one of us would want to say, but we just don't, and neither do I, so I love that part of AJ. So she's a little bit of me, but she's a lot relatable to many, many people, and especially, you know, women, and she has a child that has a disability, and, you know, AJ's just... her heartstrings are pulled upon a lot, and she wants to do right by people, but she's a little jaded, a little cynical. She's pretty up in your face and can get away with things that I don't know that I necessarily could. That makes her fun.
Sure. She is in this book approached by the owner of a brand new nuclear facility, mm-hmm. and is offered a very, very sizable check to come on board to actually not investigate wrongdoing, but kind of the opposite, to try to quell public unrest and concern about this nuclear facility. And because of her situation, she finds this monetary possibility very, very tempting. Speak a moment about folding this into the story, because I'm sure this is also a reality that activists sometimes have to face.
Well, you know, I think it's a reality a lot of times people face. I mean, The money is something that can help AJ, the law firm where she works. It can help them do more work and the right thing by a whole lot more people. It would be something that's important to her, again, with a disabled child. And I think that every single person in America, you know, wants a job and wants to earn money. And she's just afraid that the money is there for the wrong reason. Now, in this particular situation with AJ in this series, it's a catch-22. Many people are afraid of nuclear energy. We don't understand it. We have questions surrounding it. And then, of course, if there's a nuclear problem, it can be a terrible disaster. So people don't want this facility in their community. And the company brought AJ in to try to get the community to trust or believe in or allow the company to exist. And they're also developing medical isotopes. And AJ, having a disabled child, understands that, on the other hand, this nuclear facility and medical isotopes could actually enhance somebody's health. It could actually change and save somebody's life. So it's a catch-22 for her, and she's agonizing a little, but she does want to build a trust between this company and this community. And it's along those way that, once again, AJ uncovers that there is a deception. And that's the tragedy in this book and in many of these circumstances, is that this secret that is kept, this deception, doesn't have to happen. And if we could just expose that and be forthwith at the beginning, we would have a greater transparency between this company and this community.
Well, and potential problems could be so much more better addressed.
Absolutely.
This character not only echoes who you are and have been, but also echoes recent events in Japan, of course. In your novel, there is a hurricane bearing down on the coast of South Carolina, where
right.
this nuclear facility is located, and of course, that offers up another potential wrinkle in all of this of Mother Nature sometimes getting involved in some disastrous ways.
Yeah, Mother. Well, we can be better prepared. That is certain. You know, Mother Nature is not going to go away, and what happened in Japan was terrible. And I think it raises questions for all of us that, you know, possibly having nuclear facilities in earthquake-prone territories might not be a good idea. And Japan's, you know, this is one of the few options that they have. So it's very important to be better prepared. And, yes, that does raise questions for them in the book Hot Water.
Mm.
But, again, it brings to light, as we were discussing earlier, the need for being honest out the beginning, and even addressing and saying this could be a potential problem. It isn't until once we recognize that there's this potential for a problem, then we can look for a solution. So we do, when we have facilities that we know could, if there's a problem, be a disaster to many, many people, we need to become even better prepared, inform the community of that, and educate the community in that. And so some of these points are brought out in the book that are actually happening throughout America, but again, we hope told in a way that's entertaining and suspenseful that people will want to be more educated, be more aware, be more involved, because that's where we'll begin to find better solutions for our companies and our safety.
This new novel, Hot Water, is published by Vanguard Press. Aaron Brockovich, thank you very much. Best wishes and keep up the good fight.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jason and Erica Redman. Jason Redman happens to be a retired Navy SEAL, and together he and his wife have written an interesting book called Mission Invincible Marriage, a battle-tested guide to an enduring relationship. On Wednesday, we look forward to welcoming back to The Morning Show Amy Grile, Executive Director of the Kenosha Community Foundation. With her will be John Creel. He and Amy Grile have worked together recently to create a new fund that continues the philanthropic legacy of his great aunt, and it will be benefiting the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. We will talk about how that works and the ongoing good work of the Kenosha Community Foundation. On Thursday, it's Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to The Morning Show, and she has two very special guests joining her: Kenosha County Executive Samantha Kirkman and County Board Vice Chair Daniel Gashke. We will be getting an update on the Pike River Restoration Project. On Friday, I am honored to speak with Nikita Hamer, who is she is the Racine County Violent Crime Reduction Coordinator and the Wisconsin State Lead for Voices of Black Mothers. There is an event coming up sponsored by that group this Friday night, called Bigger Than Basketball. Also, Jim Schatzman and Kurt Hanrahan will be joining me on Friday's morning show to talk about the next concert of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The morning show archive is on our website, WGTD.org, and you can also subscribe to the morning show as a podcast to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be a cloudy day with a chance of some scattered rain showers this morning and possibly snow showers this afternoon. A high temperature today of 43 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight, 30% chance of snow showers. Our low drops all the way down to 23. Sunshine should return tomorrow with a high of 41 degrees. Cloudy with a rain-snow mix on Wednesday. Still cloudy on Thursday. Sunshine, though, over this coming weekend. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha.